presentation is on social epidemiology, and our presenter is Professor Spencer Moore from School of Kinesiology and Health Studies at Queen's University. And the title of the presentation by Spencer is People in Places, Understanding the Mechanisms Linking Neighborhoods to Obesity in Social Epidemiological Research.
Okay, so thank you very much for being here this afternoon. What I'd like to do is really begin with a personal confession. When I think about neighborhoods and health, I don't think about them as being the only factor or the only context that may influence our health. So as I think this comic captures a bit, when we think about neighborhoods, it's only one context, one life setting among many different socioeconomic, sociodemographic variables that can influence our health over the life course. So on this slide, as you see here in one of the respondents, I think it was my being the right race, the right religion, the right sex, the right socioeconomic group, not having the right accent, the right clothes, going to the right schools. So as I say before, it's just thinking about really neighborhoods as really one context in which individuals are embedded or are influenced by over the life course. So, and I think the socio-ecological framework here can really point to how it is that really, neighborhood settings, and you can see it here with this particular one within the community, is really just one context that we might think about that influences our health. So that being said, I'd just like to present to you really my top five reasons for studying neighborhoods and obesity. So reason number five. Neighborhoods are fuzzy and sometimes warm. So, and I'll just preface this: this is not top ten, and it's not certainly not as amusing as David Letterman's top ten. So, but if you look just a little bit at what others have said about neighborhoods, you can certainly already capture a sense of how, you know, these definitions of what a neighborhood is or isn't really shifts depending on the perspective of the researcher. So here, Max Weber, a sociologist. For in general, the neighborhood group is merely based on the simple fact that people happen to reside close to one another. So again, as we'll talk a little bit about later on, it's about kind of spatial proximity. Rodney Dangerfield, no one even tried to make it funny. I came from a real tough neighborhood. I put my hand in cement and felt another hand. So again, sort of a sense of identity, a sense of what it means to live in a particular neighborhood. And then finally, a quote from Robert Frost, good fences make good neighbors. And I think here is really pointing out how it is that sociability, neighborhood relationships can cut both ways. They can be good for your health in one situation or one context. Maybe the neighbor lives on your left versus the neighbor lives on your right who creates impediments perhaps in your daily life. So neighborhoods are a fuzzy concept, and as such, they really shift depending on how you want to frame or discuss neighborhoods. But within the socio-epidemiological research, I'd point mainly to three different ways of approaching what it is a neighborhood consists of. And these mainly involve, if you will, the question of spatial proximity. The first being thinking about neighborhoods as mainly administrative or political divisions. So you can think about particular health regions or health districts, or you might think in terms of census tracts even. But there's a certain data availability with that, right? The data usually comes packaged in those types of forms, so it's easier to integrate into your statistical analyses, and it's generally interpretable, right? Even though you can recognize that there are limits to where those neighborhoods should be divided, nevertheless, you can interpret what it is that the health district or the census tract is meant to represent there. Now, you can become more sophisticated, of course, in what you're looking and how you're looking to define a spatial unit of the neighborhood. So you can go to more geographic information systems, of course, and create what are called buffer zones. So within each individual, within you can locate the individual with a pinpoint. Let's see here. living in that particular neighborhood, create a radius around that individual, say 500 meters, 1,000 meters, really depending on how you want to define neighborhood, and from that, you know, postulate about the neighborhood effects. You become even more sophisticated. Let's say that there's a highway running through the neighborhood here. You can redefine your buffer zone to eliminate that particular section of the neighborhood. So you can really become sophisticated with how you're defining neighborhoods spatially. And one last type, which you don't really see very much in the literature, because as you move down, if you will, you get the picture, it's much more research intensive, and it really becomes more person specific, right? In terms of either buffer zones, or if we're going to concept mapping, more of a qualitative approach for, you know, one-on-one interviews, asking people to just kind of map out what it is they see as their neighborhood, and then using those maps to, define what the neighborhood is for each particular individual. So you can become more sophisticated, but of course at a cost of more expense and time investment. But these are what I'd point to as three general approaches for solving the question of what are neighborhoods. So reason number four. There's causal controversy. Now, certainly this is great for publications and debate within the field. And what I point to there is the question is, well, first of all, what is a neighborhood effect? Ideally, what you're trying to look to identify with a neighborhood effect is some kind of independent effect of the neighborhood context while you're taking into account or adjusting for individual compositional differences between those neighborhoods. So, for example, individuals who live in, we recognize the fact that individuals aren't randomly distributed across neighborhoods. People with more money tend to live in certain types of neighborhoods. People with less money tend to live in other types of neighborhoods. So what we have to be able to do is separate out those differences that are within the neighborhood based either on income, education, age composition, from what might be the overall or the neighborhood context. And this is a challenge. And there's another challenge, and that's the challenge of the causal inference. So if you're familiar with the literature, you know that most of the studies in this field are observational and they're cross-sectional. So there's a problem identifying temporal sequence, not just in terms of individuals, right, but also changes within the neighborhood, at the neighborhood level, and how changes in the neighborhood level might, again, influence individual risk for obesity. And there's also the problem of structural confounding. So this comes from a lot of the work around from Michael Oakes, and he makes the point that even if we adjust for a number of these compositional differences between individuals, these individuals that live, say, in higher income areas and those that live in lower income areas are quite different propensities for a number of risk factors for obesity. So they're not exchangeable. So our statistical models here have to deal with the question of non-exchangeability of observations. Now, and then there's another wrinkle when we come to think about what is a neighborhood effect, and that is, are we thinking about a direct effect? So are we're trying to think about, if you will, how neighborhoods might influence the risk of the average resident within that neighborhood, or do we think that neighborhoods might impact differentially on, say, older adults or children or individuals with low income in a different way than the average citizen? So is it an indirect effect, or is it a direct effect? Now I point here to some of the work we've been doing in Montreal, and this comes from a work by Catherine Paquette, who Laurette Dubé mentioned earlier this morning. But in this slide, what you see here is a differential effect in terms of the propensity or the likelihood of consuming fast food. So you can see the BES stands for the Behavioral Activation System. Individuals here with high BAS have a greater likelihood of consuming fast food when they live in an area of high fast food restaurant exposure. So they live in an area with a high density of fast food restaurants. With high BAS, they're more likely to consume fast foods compared to, say, a person with high BAS that lives in an area with a lower density of fast food restaurants. And so you can see that there's the possibility of these differential effects by individual differences on, say, a psychological scale. Here's another research we did. This is in terms of the likelihood of using or not using a park. So in this case, it's the probability of not using a park. And we're looking in this case about how it is that it changes by age. So are older adults more likely to use parks than younger adults? And our moderating variable, our neighborhood variable in this case, is age composition. So seniors that live in areas with more seniors, higher age percentage of older adults, are more likely, here in this case the blue line, right, this is non-use, so they're more likely to use the park than, say, seniors that live in areas with fewer seniors. So you can see that when we think about these indirect effects, that they may play out on a number of behavioral factors, whether it's consuming fast food, using a local park. So reason number three, you can talk about built and social environments. So here, as I say before, we're thinking about whether it's a built environment, we're talking about the local amenities within the neighborhood area, the spatially proximate area. Often frequent measures within this might be around, as I say before, fast food density, access to healthy foods. More on the physical activity side, we might have measures of park distance or density, street connectivity, urban sprawl, land use mix. And with the social environment, you may be familiar with some of these around perceived neighborhood safety, neighborhood disorder, or social capital. So these are some of the dimensions which social epidemiologists try to capture in looking at the built and social environment. But here I'll just point quickly within this slide to the question of those mechanisms. So as I say before, we're thinking about the local neighborhood amenities in terms of the built environment. Some may be protective, some may be harmful, but it's a question of exposure at this point. And so you often see in the literature whether your presence, is there a presence of these items, how far away do you live from the park, say, or the fast food restaurant, or the density, so how many of those restaurants or parks are within the area you live in. But there still remains a question. I'd say that there's still a huge gap here in what we know about how exposure relates to use. So can we say just because you're exposed to fast food restaurants, are you going to that fast food restaurant that's right down the corner? Or do you use, say, fast food at your workplace? So there's a lot of there's a gap here in what we know about how exposure actually relates back to use. So reason number two, social networks are a part of the story. So here you may be familiar with this social network. It's kind of made famous as the Framingham Heart Study through the work of Christakis and Fowler. And in that study, they looked at the spread of obesity through people's social connections. And they attribute that mainly to around the question of social contagion. And it's quite similar to social influence. I think you'd want to differentiate it around more of nonverbal cues as opposed to more verbal cues with the influence. But there are other mechanisms at play with social networks, including, say, social norms, so the values and beliefs that emerge within your local immediate network, the social support, expressive support that you receive from family, friends, and acquaintances, and also social capital in terms of the very access to resources dimension. So what we've also tried to do here in neighborhood in Montreal is to kind of disentangle that. So we know that social networks are important for a range of health outcomes, but what we wanted to do is separate out your networks from the neighborhood context. And really what's missing in a lot of the studies is the kind of data that allows you to do that. So what we did here, and this again is a slide of Montreal metropolitan area, we sampled 300 census tracts that were stratified by into tertiles of income level. But what we did is use a name generator with a sample of 2,707 Montreal adults to ask them about their core networks. And as a part of those questions, we asked where those core networks resided. As you see here in this slide, when the first person they named in the name generator tends to be within the household, and then the second, here, alter one, the highest is actually outside of the Montreal area. Then you see other individuals in the core network still are within the neighborhood context. And you see that the neighborhood side is pretty steady throughout those three alters they identified. But the key here is really to disentangle where people's social relationships are. Because as I said before, if we want to understand neighborhood as a contextual effect, right, we need to be able to separate out neighborhood from network, if you will. And so it is. So what we've done, this is a work in progress, is looking at how neighborhood socioeconomic status is associated with characteristics of a person's network. And so what we found here is that, say, Montreal neighborhoods higher in SES have residents with less educationally diverse core networks. So there's a correlation. So as you go higher in neighborhood SES, you have less diversity in your social networks. And if you're, so just really pointing out or trying to highlight the fact that these networks and neighborhoods are really entangled with one another here. Because if you're looking at the correlation, these things are moving, if you will, sort of alongside one another. And yes. So, and my top reason for studying neighborhoods and obesity. We're talking about population health. So, I mean, as we've heard a number of interesting presentations today, tended to focus more on around the individual or behavioral side. But when we start thinking about neighborhoods, and we're talking more about the population health. So, with population health approach, we're looking more at the distal determinants, so the upstream factors that influence not just physical activity, but diet, but a range of behavioral factors. As a more of an intersectoral approach, so interdisciplinary in the types of ministries and departments to bring together. And we're trying to focus on environmental change, not individual behavioral change per se. And I'll point to sort of an important figure here in defining some of the main principles of the population health approach, Jeffrey Rose, and bring out really three of his principles. The first being, we're working with a continuum of disease severity. So oftentimes we think in categorical terms. So it might be obese or not obese. It might be depressed or not. But as Rose points out, with disease are more continuous. And if we look across the population, in this case it's just the histogram of self-reported BMI in Montreal, you can see that there might be individuals at higher or lower levels of risk that you don't necessarily capture with categorical definitions. Second, his point is, whenever you see risk really diffused widely within the population, it calls for a population approach. So that it's more as the overall risk is present. So it's a population strategy that should be in place. But there is a prevention paradox. So that we are working with small individual effects, but there are large cumulative effects, as Rose points out. Okay? The idea being to be able, if you will, to either keep that distribution from shifting more to the right or somehow pushing it back to the left. So why bother after all? Okay? We can't exactly say where neighborhood boundaries lie for each person. We are limited in making causal inferences and admit that neighborhood associations may vary by intra-neighborhood group characteristics. We recognize that different dimensions may be at play at different moments in a person's life. And there even remains the added challenge of disentangling neighborhood from network effects on obesity. Well, I'd say, I mean, I think, again, going back to Rose as he makes a point, that with the population health approach, it's radical. That is, it's addressing really the modifiable root causes of disease within a population. It's appropriate and sustainable. That is, risk is widely diffused. So with the population health approach, it's aimed to really developing those environmental supports for individual behavioral change. And then finally, there are those large cumulative effects that we would look to in terms of shifting that distribution of, say, BMI in that case. So, thank you.
Thanks, Spencer, for this engaging and interesting talk. Any questions? We'll go there.
Bill Comer, University of Alberta. Interesting talk. I just wonder, I mean, the last point, and I don't know that paper by Rose, but it strikes me that it's more an assertion than actually established data. Has anybody actually done, for example, in obesity, a cost analysis of the cost of ecological intervention, which can be astonishingly high if you rebuild a city, versus individual interventions?
It doesn't have to be exactly rebuilding the city, but yeah, I mean, a lot of this leads to questions around street walkability and such. The work is from the strategy of preventative medicine, I would say in that case it's more of a, you could say, theoretical or a treatise around what a population health approach consists of. And in that work by Rose, he really contrasts it with this what he calls a high-risk strategy. So that would be the high-risk strategy is where you really target those individuals who are obese, for example. So in the idea, again, and I mean, it's an important point, and I think
you know, in terms of those types of interventions that have been able to do that, and as I think Rose points out, it leads us to more of the policy side. So thinking about maybe in terms of the policies limiting smoking here within Quebec, that would be the type of intervention that you would want to evaluate and compare it in terms of this more of this population health strategy, as opposed to, say, individual smoking intervention.
Speaking of neighborhoods, it seems from this part of the audience there are more questions given the exposure distances. So just to add a distribution in our favor, we'll go to that side of
I just a comment to follow up on Bill's question, and that's precisely where we want to move toward having reasonably aligned brain to society protocol, where you could observe individual intervention and community in sufficient sample size that you can start elaborating, looking at the relative impact, because currently, when it gets to policy, it moves to politics because we don't have an empirical basis. And that's much when we talk about the Canada, India, the multi-sites, that's really where we need to push the boundary.
Spencer, I also think it's very interesting, really nicely, you know, kind of population health. Just to quickly, you know, Sick Individuals, Sick Population was the title of Jeffrey Rose's paper, and I think it has been empirically shown in tobacco control and tobacco elimination research.
But that's the only example, right?
Hmm? Well, no, there are other etiological fraction, attributable risk, you know, of a disease. So, I mean, mathematically, this has been shown, you know, the amount of prevention, you know, when you take a population versus a more individually based, you know, behavioral approach, right? Mm-hmm. My question, Spencer, was really around self-selection in the neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. So, and I think as you've appropriately pointed out, people are not randomly distributed in whatever geospatial unit you're looking at. And that the forces that gets people selected into a neighborhood, because it is a behavior, could be confounding, could be, you know, their outcomes as well as their mediators, you know. So I know that people who work on neighborhood health research, this is a huge challenge in trying to pass out.
Yeah.
I wonder what your thoughts are on that whole issue and how you go about thinking and implementing a strategy where the sorting into neighborhoods, self-selection into neighborhoods, is somehow teased apart from the actual effects of social or physical structures of neighborhoods.
Yeah, I wish I could point to a clear strategy with that. I think, you know, with the work of Oakes, for example, you know, more of a statistical approach that he recommends, more of what's called propensity score matching. Sometimes it gives slightly different results than just a traditional kind of a regression analysis. The other is, you know, Oakes also suggests a type of randomized control trial, which we kind of recognize in this kind of setting is not really very feasible. So in terms of the modeling, I think there remains that challenge to sort out those kind of compositional and, as you point out, the self-selection biases in those samples. In my own work at this point, what I've tried to focus on is more in trying to disentangle the network component, so people's social relationships in the neighborhood, from that neighborhood context. So,
people could choose to live in a neighborhood because they have people they know.
Exactly.
You know,
so I think
they have their babysitter or they have their friends, so they select themselves into the neighborhood to be like-minded or like, you know, in the same social network. So you see,
I agree. Yeah.
I had one comment on this. I guess they're not Lawrence or ghettos or communities in every sort of cosmopolitan city, but when people belong to sort of minority groups or marginal groups, they don't always sort of go to their own sort of self-chosen communities necessarily. They may want to remain anonymous. There is some small literature growing what people call exit rights, meaning that you might have a self-assigned sort of minority group to yourself, but some people sort of want to have exit right from that as well, and they live in different communities. So this happens in some cosmopolitan cities where people, you know, are sort of not identifiable in these other communities that they live. So I wonder how the social network analysis actually can get into those kind of things, because those are sort of invisible voices. So they might want a certain minority group, however it might be defined, but they're not necessarily in that group. They're sort of diffused into the other system. And there might be different reasons for it. You might be a immigrant group, and you may sort of feel threatened, etc., and you may also diffuse into other immigrant groups. And people do that usually in the first sort of generation immigrant groups. So I wonder how the social networks can get into these sort of invisible voices, if you will, or self-chosen, self-induced invisible voices.
Well, you know, oftentimes there's what's called this like snowball sampling within a network methodology, where it's meant to, you know, identify, uncover more hidden populations. So, I mean, there are methodological approaches that might seek to kind of address that particular issue. But again, with any kind of network approach, it's often very research intensive, and the instruments you can use can be tailored to your specific research question. So I think it's just a matter of really designing the kind of a sophisticated study to allow you to reach those particular groups.
Yeah. Any other questions? Okay, well, thank you very much. So our next speaker will